The film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Bernhardt's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm out to sing songs. It'll prove to you that this is your world. And that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Matt Hurley of Pacifica Radio in Ames, Iowa. On today's Sprouts Thanksgiving edition, we will hear from Paul Ingalls, producer of Peace Talks Radio, discussing the Wampanoag leader Massasoit and the fabled First Thanksgiving between the Native Americans and early colonists.
I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. In 2009, I was watching the PBS television series We Shall Remain, five parts on key moments in Native American history. The first episode opened with dramatized scenes of what's come to be known as the First Thanksgiving in Plymouth Colony, what would later become Massachusetts.
Almost nothing is known about the most iconic feast in American history, not even the date. It happened most likely in the late summer of 1621, a little less than a year after the Wampanoag saw a small group of strangers land on their shores. Half these strangers, men, women, and children, had died of disease, hunger, or exposure in their first winter on the unforgiving edge of North America. But by the next summer, with the help of the Wampanoag, the Pilgrims had taken a harvest sure to sustain the settlement through the next barren season. And they meant to celebrate their faith that God had smiled on their endeavor. As the Thanksgiving began, a group of Wampanoag men, led by their chief, Massasoit, entered the Plymouth settlement, not entirely sure of the reception they'd get.
In 2010, I talked with the episode's director, Chris Eyre, who'd been charged with imagining what the feast might have looked like. Coincidentally, the night before we talked, he caught a rebroadcast of the episode on his local station. I saw on the website that historians have only been able to find about two lines of a reference even to a First Thanksgiving.
Isn't that incredible?
How did you manage to shape your depiction of the event from that?
Well, we took the two lines and basically said, okay, out of this, we can, you know, extrapolate that there were indigenous foods, beans and rice and wild turkey, probably some deer. And, you know, there was a menu made through our historians and production. And then we just started to build from, you know, what state was the settlement in. You know, you think, okay, do they sit down? Do some of them sit down? Do they stand around? You know, what's the mood? Do the settlers try and formalize the situation? Is it, you know, real casual? Are they laughing? Are they interacting? Are the Indians offering their indigenous food? we came up with working with the actors and just kind of playing around with different ideas.
And yet, in your depiction of the Thanksgiving, it seems like anyone, Anglo or Native, who would be watching that, imagining and sharing a wish that the goodness and the sharing had lasted in our history, although it certainly did not. But was the hope of that moment a goal for you to depict finally, and particularly since you just watched it again recently?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my thinking exactly. I mean, when they come and shake hands and then they start to eat, you know, you're hoping that this is all going to be well and good. And so I think that's where you start to know that, wait a minute, this can't last. And that's where the drama lies.
For those who follow the pilgrims across the Atlantic, the first Thanksgiving would enter into national mythology, where it remains the bright opening chapter of the American creation story. For the Wampanoag and for Massasoit, the memory of that day would recede into darker places, shadowed by betrayal and loss.
A clip from We Shall Remain and the episode After the Mayflower, directed by our guest Chris Eyre. Although the program began with a depiction of the first Thanksgiving, it's really the story of a Wampanoag chief who came to be known as Massasoit, who chose to cooperate with the Pilgrims and form an alliance. He struck an agreement that some see as the first peace treaty between Native Americans and British settlers. Others call it a war alliance of convenience to both parties, who needed something the other offered for a time. We'll have more with We Shall Remain director Chris Eyre later, but first, from Plymouth Plantation in Plymouth, Massachusetts, we have on the line with us two Native American scholars of this period in history, Darius Coombs and Bob Charlebois. Welcome to you both. While we want to focus on Massasoit's alliance with the Plymouth colony, what's important to say about the introduction of European settlers to this particular region in the years before 1620 and 1621, when Massasoit chose to engage them? Were there not several decades of contact prior to that? Darius Coombs?
Yeah, and that's very important to mention, because you think of 1620, and a lot of people think first people here, aside from Native people. But we had people coming over minimum 100 years prior. There were Dutch people coming over, they're English, and they're French. The first written recording of people coming was a man named Verrazano, who landed down in Rhode Island and traded with the Narragansett down there. But most likely there were people coming over long before that even. They didn't really care about the land. They wanted to do business. They wanted beaver pelts. They wanted otter pelts. And they also wanted people. And there were ships coming over taking Native people back over to Europe and teaching them their language, parts of their culture, then bring them back over as guides and interpreters. So land wasn't a big deal for them.
Right, and so the difference in those earlier years is that we're not talking about settlements per se.
No, that's made it a little favorable when the colonists landed here in 1620, because when they came, they brought women and children along, and there were the traders who didn't do a lot of nice stuff, you know. So what made them, the colonists, better off for themselves is when they did bring their women and children, meant to, in a way, a friendlier type of people.
Well, you could argue that Massasoit had many reasons to distrust or maybe even want to eliminate the settlers based on those experiences with the English in this region, just in the time before the Pilgrims landed, because of what you said. You know, they were abducting some Native Americans, enslaving them, taking them back to Europe, bringing disease that decimated some tribes.
That's true. I'll handle this. This is Bob. There were about 4 years before they came, there was an outbreak of what appears to be the bubonic plague. And it started up in Maine, and it went down south in sort of a rayon of death, if you will, all the way through where Boston is now, down to the south coast of Massachusetts. It cut Wampanoag country in two. The survivors of that were on Cape Cod and in the islands, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, the Elizabeth Islands, and so forth, and in a little area south of Providence, Rhode Island. That area which is where the Poconoket people live, that was Massasoit's people, would have been in a particular quandary, because in normal times they had enough men in their warrior societies to balance out their opponents, their enemies to the west. It would have been the Narragansetts. They had parity in most and it kept the peace in normal times. But now they had about 1/10 of the amount of men that they had had prior to that. As a result, there were rumors being made and so forth by the Narragansetts. They were going to come in and take Massasoit's area. And he was looking for an ace to pull out of his pocket, if you will. And when he had heard that Europeans had arrived in Plymouth, he just, he was very happy. And I think he thought, Europeans, big metal guns, let's make a deal here. So
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit more. But let me ask you to reflect a little bit on Massasoit. What is known about him as a tribal leader before this devastation that you just described, when incredibly, 9 out of 10 of his people were lost to these diseases? One reference book said he always was inclined to peace, even among his own race. Would you agree with that? And is there anything in his story that supports that before this encounter with the Pilgrims?
You know, there's not a whole lot known about Massasoit. There are bits and pieces that are written about him. Massasoit was a revered leader, and it wasn't based on fear. It was based on love. So we know that about him. Whether or not he was inclined to peace, we're not sure about that, you know. He was inclined to do the best thing for his people at the time, which would have secured their peace and their well-being. I don't know if he was someone who was inclined towards being offensive militarily or anything of that sort, but we don't know. We just don't know.
You hear about Massasoit being a great leader, a great sachem, great chief. He was smart enough to come out here in the spring of 1621 to Plymouth Colony and make a war alliance. I wouldn't even call it a peace alliance. It was more or less like a war alliance with the colonists before a Narragansett chief most likely would have been Canonicus. So have that alliance going on to help fight off the Narragansett people.
Mm-hmm. So he started to observe this Plymouth community from the outskirts.
Yeah, there were signs that Massasoit knew about the people being out here. But the first time there was a native person going into the Pilgrim village was in March of 1621. Actually, a chief went into the village. It wasn't a Wampanoag chief. It was a chief from up in Maine. His name was Samoset. He came down earlier with a trade ship and was let loose pretty much. And Massasoit, being a smart man, he wasn't dumb, said, "Samoset, you're a leader. You're a sachem. You're a chief. You know how to speak English. You dealt with these people before. Why don't you go into that village and see what's going on?" And Samoset walked into the Plymouth Colony in March of 1621 with just a breechcloth on. And he told them what had happened, the plague that came through here, asked him why they were here. They told him, they sat him down, they fed him, they gave him something to drink. And then he told him, "Well, I'm not from here, but I'm going to bring you a leader who is familiar with this area, who is from here." And that's when he ran back and told Massasoit, "All right, it was all right to come along." And that's when he brought himself and 60 of his men. And that's when they sat down and made that very famous war treaty. I stress war treaty because it really wasn't a peace treaty. You're talking about two different people, totally. One thinking one side and the other thinking another, you know. Friendship is even a strong word to use back then. You hear that a lot. Languages were different. Cultures were different. It was hard enough to understand each other than have be friends, but that's when that very famous treaty was established.
"My king welcomes you here."
"Ka na naman kwetatawa wasame sasi ogi yu."
This is one of the very first of these treaty encounters that are going to become such an important part of Anglo-American relations with Indian peoples across the continent.
"We want to be at peace with you. We want you to promise that none of your people will harm any of our people."
"Uten, Kakantam, Wanakenia, Wanatei Nashvi Ninawa."
"Anunas mata no waski ao nanog."
"Let us agree then that if anyone unjustly attack you, then we will help you. And if any unjustly attack us, then you will help us.
The treaty negotiation scene as presented in the PBS series We Shall Remain. Let me read the points of this agreement as recalled in a memoir written by William Bradford, who for many, many years was the governor of Plymouth Colony. It says, after friendly entertainment and some gifts given to him, the settlers made peace with him, which hath now continued this 24 years at the time of this writing, in these terms. Number one, that neither he nor any of his should injure or do hurt to any of their people. Number two, that if any of his did any hurt to any of theirs, he should send the offender that they might punish him. Number three, that if anything were taken away from any of theirs, he should cause it to be restored, and that they should do the like to his. Number four, that if any did unjustly war against him, that they would aid him, and if any did war against them, he would aid them. Number five, that he should send to his neighbors confederates to certify them of this, that they might not wrong them, but might be likewise compromised in the conditions of peace. And number six, that when their men came to them, they should leave their bows and arrows behind them. So one writer I read about this offered the opinion that seems similar to what you gentlemen are saying, that the two groups came together not because they necessarily valued peace or respect for each other that much as a concept, but because they saw cooperation as the only way to cater to their respective self-serving advantages.
Yeah, they had landed for them during a good time for themselves. They needed an ally because of what the traders had done prior, and Massasoit needed an ally because of the disease that happened. He did not want the Narragansetts taking over his area. Nor did the colonists want other Native people attacking them.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today we're hearing from Paul Ingalls discussing Wampanoag leader Massasoit and the fabled First Thanksgiving between the Native Americans and early colonists.
This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're exploring a treaty agreement made in 1621 between Native American chief Massasoit and the English settlers of Plymouth Plantation. Whether called a peace pact or a strategic alliance, the cooperation set forth in the agreement lasted about 40 years until after Massasoit's death and the subsequent outbreak of the bloody King Philip's War between the Native American tribes and the British that ultimately resulted in the deaths of some 600 colonists and as many as 3,000 Native Americans from war and disease. Our guests are Native American scholars Darius Coombs and Bob Charlebois, both speaking to us from Plymouth Plantation, an educational museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Later we'll hear more from Native American film director Chris Eyre, who worked on several episodes of the 2009 PBS documentary series We Shall Remain, including the episode called After the Mayflower, which featured the story of Massasoit. Let me ask Bob Charlebois, in the years following the 1621 agreement, how did the settlers end up aiding Massasoit and vice versa? Were there instances when the treaty was actually put into practice?
There were a few, and it was evident in those instances where that occurred, that the might of the English was shown. Massasoit was correct. You know, the weapons were a very powerful tool to those unacquainted with them, and that would have been the native people here.
Did the negotiation of these points, though, lead to anything that wouldn't have happened otherwise, like integration of the cultures in any way, or learning of each other, acceptance of each other, that might not have happened if it hadn't been manufactured?
I would have to say no, not because you're talking about, like I was saying, two totally different cultures. If anything at all, this treaty was just a more or less like a war treaty. And when you have treaties like that, you don't really have to be friends with the people. It's a business agreement, basically, and that's what it was.
The Pilgrims, they were a very insular people. They wouldn't have been open to dealing with Native people. When you come here to Plymouth Plantation, you'll see a huge palisade around the whole thing, and it makes one wonder. It's a food for thought item. Why did they need it? They were obviously afraid of the unknown, and who wouldn't be, you know? They had come from thousands of miles away into a very different world.
Right. Well, what feels like the take-home message to learn from considering this particular story in terms of peacemaking philosophy that could inform people who care about peacemaking?
Well, personally, I don't think we should abandon the effort to make peace in the world. I think it's important. I think I'd have to hang up my cleats, so to speak, if I did. I felt it about that way. But I think this is just another example. It was the model by which Europeans and later the United States went from the East Coast to the Pacific. Make a treaty, break it, and it's sort of a two steps forward, one step back process, and they kept doing it back and forth and back and forth. I mean, whether you're looking at the history of the treaties with the Lakota Nation, or you know, the wars against the Apaches or the Comanches in Texas, and or the Shawnee, like which is an all and we shall remain, you know. And you know, it's got to be laid out there. It's got to be understood as to what happened, you know. That dialogue is all important. I'm a big dialogue guy.
Bob Charlebois and Darius Coombs are both Native American scholars affiliated with the Plymouth Plantation Museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts, from where they spoke to us. Cheyenne Arapaho film director Chris Eyre, known for his movies Smoke Signals and Skins and Skinwalkers, also directed several installments in the 5-part PBS series We Shall Remain, which you can view, by the way, via a link on our website, peacetalksradio.com. I talked more with Chris about his telling of the tale of Massasoit in the series' first episode, After the Mayflower, which featured dramatic reenactments of the history paired with commentary from scholars of those times.
There's a very clear sense that Massasoit understands the entire treaty as reciprocal. At the very end of the treaty, it says, if you do these things, then King James will esteem you his friend and ally. So it would make very good sense for the Indians to think this is an alliance. This is a meeting between friends.
That was historian Jenny Hale Pulsifer, who interprets Massasoit's outreach as saying, we're the same people now. Plymouth Plantation native historian Darius Coombs, whom we spoke with earlier, might disagree with that, saying how different the cultures were, how they would never be the same people. He said at best they tolerated each other. Chris Eyre, without a written record of Massasoit's thinking, are we sort of destined to see it through either the hopeful or skeptical filter of a particular historian, do you think?
I hope not. That's my greatest hope, is that we embrace the gray areas in our history, in that we don't, you know, demonize what we don't understand or believe in, and that at the same, you know, time, we don't, you know, aren't so blind that we just see only what we see and exalt that too. I mean, like I said, We Shall Remain, you know, not to get off the After the Mayflower with Massasoit, but, you know, in the case of Wes Studi's character in the Cherokee movie, he had always been taught that the character of Major Ridge was the villain to Cherokee people. And Wes commented to me that he appreciated playing this character that was supposedly a villain because he never thinks of his characters as bad. He always plays them as good. And that goes for, you know, his role in Last of the Mohicans, which was Magua, who was this, you know, complete terror in Last of the Mohicans. And I think that it's the same with Massasoit, it's the same with King Philip, it's the same with the settlers. I mean, the settlers, I'm sitting there watching the series last night, when these, you know, ships are coming across the ocean and they land at Plymouth and people get out, they're not thinking, hey, we'd like to kill people. I mean, it's not that black and white. They're thinking they'd like a better life than what they left. And I always think to myself, you know, I don't know what the component is that turns it into crimes of war. But it's just an interesting subject that I hope that we never stop asking the question and pondering what choices we would have made had we been in the same shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to ask you specifically, what did you hope to leave the viewers with in your portrayal of Massasoit? I think you kind of answered it there, but can you apply specifically, you know, with this particular character, the sort of nuanced approach that it sounds like you were trying to apply to all characters in this series?
I mean, what I try and do is apply, you know, the rock and the hard place allegory, which is, you know, whether you're a farmer in this country or whether you're a, you know, out of work salesperson in this country, I try to apply the statement or the idea that it could happen to anyone and that we shouldn't be so quick with our judgments as to right and wrong. Sometimes there are circumstances. And in the case of the American, Native American, you know, conflict that happened then or that happens now, it's not driven by evil people, I don't think, all the time. It's driven by misinformation. It's driven by politics. It's driven by populace. It's driven by money. But I don't think its core is, you know, evil people or bad people. I think it's about people that are segregated, and each group of people are trying to exist, trying to live, trying to get ahead. So, you know, when I'm portraying Massasoit or I'm portraying pilgrims in this case, if I get into the gray areas with representation of anybody, then I'm happy. If the character comes out black or white, I think that that's too easy. And so, you know, with Massasoit, he was a gentleman who was caught between a rock and a hard place. He had some incredibly difficult decisions to make, such as a peace treaty, such as should he have done something to stop people in the very beginning. He was a man who made a lot of choices because of the shoes he was in, and I don't think it's fair to go back and say he made wrong or right choices. He was somebody who was doing the best he could do given the circumstance, and maybe the circumstance didn't allow for anything else at that time. Who knows?
You've already disclaimed yourself as not a scholar, but I'm curious still about your take on this particular story because of this debate about whether or not it really was a moment of peace to celebrate or reflect on. How do you feel about it as you sort of look back on the 40 years of sustained, if tenuous, peace that Massasoit was able to, along with certain leaders of the British colony, maintain?
My take is that it's a tribute to Massasoit's leadership that there was a 40-year place of peace. I think that's a tribute to his leadership. I mean, you know, we came down to this same conflict over and over and over again in the We Shall Remain series. In the case of Massasoit, I mean, what was the alternative? That he start, you know, killing settlers, I guess. I don't know what the alternative is, you know?
For you, after working on this film, and for viewers after watching it, what do you think is the value in contemplating these fleeting moments of peace and cooperation, however tentative or even self-serving, as some of the historians would say that they might have been?
These moments are all pieces of our past as Americans that we need to not forget in order to go forward. I mean, when we talk about, you know, things like immigration, and we talk about the war in Afghanistan, and we talk about the Middle East, these are all important growing pains that this country's gone through that we need to better understand and make sure that we continue, you know, as America in a good way, as the greatest country in the world. And I think that that's the only way that we can do so, is to look at our history and actually own the history that we've been a part of, which we quite, to this point, we quite haven't done. But, you know, these are important lessons that we look at and we say, hey, you know, we've been here before.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to Paul Ingalls discussing Wampanoag leader Massasoit and the fabled First Thanksgiving between the Native Americans and early colonists. The program was produced by Paul Ingalls, producer of Peace Talks Radio, whose website is peacetalksradio.com. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org.
Tune in every Friday at 3 p.m. for Roots of Rock and Roll. Dale Farr and Steve Bricker play rare and vintage records from rhythm and blues, jump blues, rockabilly, and doo-wop. From the birth of rock and roll, the 50s and early 60s. Roots of Rock and Roll, only on KBOO Portland.
Support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform that old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information, call 1-877-526-6123. That's 877-KBOO-123. Or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.